Shall we start with an easy one? Where do you stand on Donald Trump? What do you think of him? I had a little one-minute video to share with you tonight. I have been very irresponsible and given no notice whatsoever to our wonderful projectionist. So I will narrate what was going to happen in that video, okay? It's all completely my fault. Two people discuss Donald Trump, and the super interesting thing is that these political commentators start talking about how complex some of the things that Trump has done are. You know, he was in construction, and that was very stressful. He succeeded on TV as well, so he seems to be a very stress-resistant person. He is no dummy, they say. He is not stupid. If he weren't smart, he wouldn't have succeeded in some of these things. Now, a lot of people seem to dislike Donald Trump. A lot of people seem to like him. I don't know which camp you're in, and you're already probably weirded out by the fact that I started this with politics. But how did it make you feel to hear Trump spoken well of? Many of my friends would have felt shock and then proceeded to badmouth whoever gave him any compliments. Now, we can be just as surprised when in our Bible text tonight, the master ends up praising someone who just seems to be a really bad person that we wouldn't want to be associated with. Jesus always shocks with a reason, and he turns our ideas about God's kingdom completely upside down, and we're going to see why. Just like the two people in the conversation I referred to make a distinction between whether Trump is shrewd and smart and resilient and whether he's a man of good character, they drive a wedge between the two, so Jesus will tell a story where we are obliged to do the same. We can say that someone is clever but uses their intelligence in unwise ways. So Jesus has a few surprises for us tonight, I believe. And that just about begins to touch on why this passage is so tricky. Okay, a few reasons. In verse 1, the rich man, by the way, we're in Luke 16. And I haven't told you where we are. You don't know what's happening unless you looked at the program before. But in Luke 16, in verse 1, this rich man, we're going to read his story together, dismissed his manager for being dishonest, for wasting his possessions. But then in verse 8, he praises him. He's saying, well done for being so clever. I don't get that. Is the main character in this story actually a bit of a Robin Hood type hero who steals from the rich and gives to the poor? Or was he just a villain who got caught in his lack of honesty? And in verse 8, when it says that the master commended the dishonest manager because of the way he acted, is Jesus saying we should be dishonest? All these questions, as we read this verse in Luke 16, make us want to ask, why is this parable in the Bible? Couldn't you have told them, Jesus, a more straightforward story? Okay. But as we begin to read the story, you will see that the context is one of instruction to the disciples. It's a parable for Christians about how they should live with eternity stamped on their minds. Okay, so that said, let's enjoy the parable before we interpret it together. So there'll be some images on the screen as I read it, if you are more of a visual person. I'll just pass it on. Let's read it. Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what's this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he called each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 3,000 liters of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 1,500. Then he asked the second, how much do you owe? 30 tons of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 24. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. The Pharisees who loved money heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. Let's talk about a few interesting details, because if this were a movie, we'd have a few kind of scenes going on. The first one, the scene is set in verses 1 and 2. And, you know, having been told in chapter 15, the parable of the lost two sons, where one of the sons squanders his father's possessions, we now find ourselves with another parable where someone mismanages another person's possessions. It's kind of the equivalent of fairly dismissing someone, but giving them some time to gather their things. In this case, it doesn't seem like the best idea, does it? Extra chances to get nasty and to leave things in a mess for the person coming after you. This manager was possibly a slave with some special responsibilities. Don't think slaves in like a few hundred years ago in America. Think a slave with more like an employee, because he's handling a lot of money. You know, at the time, slaves could do business transactions for their masters. They could sell property, deal with personnel, be medics and teachers. There was absolutely no hint, though, in this parable that the manager was honest. He doesn't even try to explain himself. He just takes the assessment, okay, I'm fired, I'm not even going to argue it, I'm fairly dismissed. That's scene number one. Scene number two, this plan is hatched in verses 3 and 4. At first, he falls in despair. There's no welfare system. There's no other occupation available for this man who previously had a powerful job. He hasn't got the build, gained through life experiences to do manual labor. Maybe he was a little bit like me, couldn't lift anything. Could this be like someone who is fired from doing maybe a niche job or something like that? They're not trained for anything else, and so maybe he was despairing like a miner whose workplace is closed and who doesn't have a degree in anything else. But then he has this aha moment. The plan is hatched when he realizes that he can do what one commentator describes as using what got him into trouble to get him out of trouble. This is like maybe a shop floor employee who can fudge the numbers and make, you know, some debtors happy without knowledge of their CEO, without their CEO knowing. And therein lies, my friends, the shrewdness. So the plan is hatched, but now verses 5 to 7, it's executed. How is he going to do it? He gets all these like IOU notes, and instead of these people owing his master, they now owe an emotional debt to him, so that when he's fired, he'll have some good contacts. This is big stuff. I mean, 100 measures of oil could be as much as 900 gallons, more than a year's worth of income. A 50% discount is a nice way to be in someone's good books, isn't it? The wheat example is even worse. As one commentator points out, it's equivalent to several years' wages. So this plan has been hatched, has been executed. We need to know, was it worth it? Has it worked? Does the strategy pay off? Here's the next scene. Verse 8, the plan does seem to. It is praised. It certainly seems to have gone well, but why was the man praised? Notice that in verse 8, the person in this story does not praise the man himself or his bad character. He praises his shrewdness, his prudence, or some people might say his wisdom. He might have an awful character, but he's as clever as they come. And the confusion is really that we don't realize that in verse 8, The manager's character is described as dishonest, but his actions as shrewd. So he commends the actions, the wisdom, and not the character. Hopefully you can draw a distinction between the two slightly. In other words, Jesus is going to draw some lessons for Christians here from how this man responded strategically to the situation, rather than telling all of us that we need to be corrupt. Okay? So I think there's, before we move on to some different stuff, there is all the difference in the world between saying, well done for being corrupt, and saying, what a clever way to plan for the future, even though it was illegal. So he's recognizing someone's shrewdness rather than saying his character is great. So then, now we know a little bit more about that story that you see there. What difference does it make to my life? Why is this here in the scriptures? I'm going to challenge you with a few different thoughts. And they are to be shrewd with your money and a few other things. So be shrewd with your money for people's sake in verse 8. The people of this world, people who live their lives without regard to God, people who are not part of Jesus' family, how do they live in verse 8? Well, they use their money to secure friendships that are going to last a long time. Well, how do people of the light live, followers of Jesus? Well, I think often we are really quite passive and unresponsive to situations. We tend to want to duck and hide rather than be active. We tend to be a little bit more Amish and secluded from everyone rather than Puritan, a little bit more active. Talk to me more about this later. That's not true, though, of this shrewd manager. He faces the situation squarely. He hatches a plan in the midst of his despair, and he's thought about his future carefully and acted on it. Do we, as Christians, are we concerned to spend our money and resources on others because we hope to spend eternity with them? Notice the reference to eternal dwellings. Or do we behave as if, oh well, you know, this world is going to burn up anyway, instead of living in this world in the most productive way that we can? It does seem like, ultimately here, the person that we gain by using our resources well is God. I'm remembering here Matthew 10:42, where Jesus says, if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones who is my disciple, truly I tell you, that person will certainly not lose their reward. So we as Christians, if you believe in Jesus as I do, use our money, our wits, our wealth to honor our God, looking forward to living in his eternal dwellings. So we want to ask, do we invest money in the needs of other people to bless them? Or do we only spend money on ourselves and our children? We want to see other people succeed in their well-being and hopefully in spending eternity with them. So let's be shrewd with our money for people's sake. Let me add a little caveat, though, before you think that I'm saying going into eternity is all about being a good person. Jesus is not saying here that people should use their money to earn their place in God's family, but he is telling you and I, if we are already his followers, that we ought to demonstrate that we are living a life that honors God, especially in the area of worldly wealth, of money, where our first loves might be hiding. But secondly, be shrewd with your money because you don't have much, verses 10 and 11. Do you have that person in your life who borrows things but can never remember to return it? Do you have that? Yeah, if you know me and you've lent me stuff, I am that person. I do apologize now. What about someone who borrows things, but say if they're books, they're returned to you dog-eared, DVDs with an extra scratch, cars, perish the thought, with an added dent? How would you expect that person to treat your stuff if you carried lending it to them? If they returned one book dog-eared, would it be any different if you lent them five books? If they were careless with two DVDs, would loaning them 50 make them careful? You can kind of see where I'm going with this. If we don't have much of whatever it is and still don't use it wisely or shrewdly, how will we be faithful with more than what we have? In my very limited experience of the world, there's this immense difference normally between like rags to riches, wealthy people, and I inherited everything, wealthy people. The former tend to be a little bit more careful with the little because they remember what it was like when they didn't have it. And there's the potential for certain humility when someone has been faithful with little and grown to be faithful in much. It just made me want to ask, reading this passage, are we being faithful with our little money, our little time, our few resources? If we are not faithful as Christians because we say, well, I just don't have enough money to give to a good cause like Compassion UK or Release International, then I think we've missed the point of what it means to be faithful in little. Have we missed the point, perhaps, if we say, well, I won't really disciple anyone because I haven't got the time to meet with them? Well, let's meet with the time that we do have. Make a difference with the little that we've been entrusted with. 1 hour every month to bless someone. To start small, because that's what we have to do. So it's precisely because we don't have much of something that you and I need to be faithful with it. One day the faithfulness, Jesus says, with little will mean we are entrusted with true heavenly eternal riches with God. So let's allow him to be changing our lives. But be shrewd also with your money because it's not yours. By now you can tell money also means resources. Look at verse 12 again. Just remind yourself of what it says. So you're careful to spend it wisely as the person who's taking care of something for someone else. I remember when someone who lived here in Natter Street, hereabouts, asked us to house sit for them as a nice thing for us. They had this, five or six bedroom, three story property, beautiful, that their employer had provided for them. To this day, I'm still nervous that I have not left it as clean and tidy as I found it. I'm a considerably messy person. Now, that's because I care more about other people's stuff than my stuff. So, do I care that much about what God has entrusted to me? I think the extent to which I care about something is proportional to the importance of the owner and the cost of the thing itself. So, someone else's car, for example. If I borrowed, say, a Jag, I'd never borrow that because I'd have to sell a kidney to pay for a scratch or something like that. Compare this with my car. I have a little Ford KA. It's a bit dented. It got scratched at Core Cabbie. This lady left me a really nice note. And I thought, it's no big deal. What's another scratch? Not very careful. But we are more careful with stuff that isn't ours. Do we realize that if you're a Christian like me, your money, my money, isn't actually ours? I don't think about that a lot of the time. When the opportunity to go away on holiday or to buy a gadget or a book I like comes up, I just think, can I afford it or not? Rather than, does my spending still allow me to give to a worthy cause? This works with other resources too, if all of our lives belong to God. Am I spending money like it's my money or God's money? Am I filling up my diary every week with things that only serve me or things that serve other people? Does my diary show that I understand my time belongs to God? But also, be shrewd with your money because devotion to God dethrones money. And I'm taking that from verse 13. No one can serve two masters. I've only been married for 5 years. It's going to be 6 next year. Very exciting about that. I know that's like a baby next to your, monumental marriages here tonight. But one of the things I have learned is certainly the exclusive nature of love within marriage. Now, unlike the love of between friends, it's not open-ended. It's exclusive. I think by its very nature, it can't be anything but exclusive. For example, do you think that you can properly, covenantally love 3 spouses? Can you do that? Well, you don't seem so sure. Throughout the Bible, it doesn't really seem to work for people. From Abraham to Solomon and onwards, they seem to regret having many spouses. My wife, singular. must be worthy of my time. She, you know, must be worthy of me not filling out my diary without consulting her. In my decision making, my possessions must be shared. The more I keep from her, the less abundant my commitment and my love is to her and for her. The very nature of this love and devotion demands a lot from us. And in a similar way, as I read this passage, our love for God spills over into all these other areas of life. Just as I can't spend large amounts of money without consulting my wife, I can't fill up my diary and furnish my mind with thoughts that never say, I wonder what God thinks about this. The problem with saying that God, wanting to know what God thinks about it, is he might actually say something about our monthly giving. He might say something about our generosity in our service to others, or our lack of it. The love of money is completely the opposite of this, as Jesus says. While God might say, look, earn less money, accomplish less things, so that you perhaps can give to this cause, or be a better husband with more time at home, or a better father, or a better friend. The love of money, conversely, says, ditch people, you don't need them. They're holding you back. Spending time with your family is holding you back from your next promotion. My prayer is on this point that God will help us to continue to love the true and loving Master. If we devote ourselves to him, he will be number one. And that's what I mean by he will be enthroned. Money won't be loved, but used for God's glory. But lastly, be shrewd with your money against all expectations. And the Pharisees come into view at this point in our passage. Let me ask you, why do we make money in the first place? Is it just to survive? I don't think so. I think we want to do a lot more with our money and our time. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, had this apparently recurring theme in his sermons, and he would say, earn all you can, save all you can, so that you can give all you can. What a really challenging thought that is, especially if you apply it to time and resources and other things. Another challenging thought is that living and breathing next to people who do worship money means sometimes being challenged by them, perhaps being laughed at if they find out that you give the X amount of money to a worthy cause. I've been actually surprised in this church by people who are very wealthy, but don't drive the snazziest car they can, who take on jokes from co-workers, who sneer at the very idea of giving away money to a pointless cause. Pointless because they don't believe God exists, of course. So as we finish our time together in this part of the service, we are shrewd with our money, with our time, with our resources, not because other people approve of it. The Pharisees in Jesus' day in this instance certainly didn't. We don't stop serving God in this way when people criticize us or make fun of us for living below our means, as it were. We defy expectations and we move forward regardless of people who, like the Pharisees' response to Jesus' teaching, might poke fun at a God-centered lifestyle. After all, we are shrewd with our money and resources because of what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 8:9. It reads, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich spiritually. And with that truth firmly branded in our hearts, we pray that God is going to help us to be as generous with all that we have and own as he has been with us when we believed in this in his son Jesus. So let me pray for you and for myself. Dear Father, what a challenging thought that you demand from us that we love you above our money, above our possessions, that we put everything you've given us to good use in your service to bless others. Father, help us to do that. It's very hard, especially when many people around us aren't necessarily doing the same. Thank you that being a part of your family means we don't have to do any of these things to impress you. We can try and do them as a way of saying thank you to you, for you have loved us richly when we were poor. In Jesus' name we thank you. Amen.